It doomed it as a viable American political theory. Progressives had made a dark bargain with the voters. On the one hand, they sought women's rights, which liberated women often to act as men. On the other hand, they sought to constrain liberties across a wide range of economic, social, and behavioral issues. Women could vote, but now they could not drink. They could start businesses, but could not expand those companies lest they fall prey to antitrust fervor. Likewise, men found that progressive policies had freed them from the dominance of the state legislators when it came to electing their senators, but then they learned that the states lacked the power to insulate them from arbitrary actions by the federal government. Voters could recall their judges, but at the cost of allowing them to make tough, unpopular decisions. They could initiate legislation, swamping ballots with scores of legal-sounding and unfathomable proposals. And the income tax, hailed as the measure to redistribute wealth, succeeded only in taking more wealth than ever from those least able to pay it. Small wonder that in 1920, Americans, for the most part, were ready to ditch progressivism. Chapter 15, The Roaring Twenties and the Great Crash, 1920-32. The Twenties Myth. Many recent histories, including textbooks, have developed a mythology about the Roaring Twenties and the Great Crash of 1929. Although it is tempting to call this mythology the liberal legend, it would be inaccurate, because elements of it have been echoed by conservative historians, most recently Paul Johnson, and to some extent by libertarian economists like Murray Rothbard. Despite some recent challenges in scholarship, this liberal legend remains dominant, and the essentials of this story have remained the same for decades. During the 1920s, the story goes, the wild speculation in the stock market led to a maladjustment of wealth on the one hand and too much investment on the other. Average Americans could not buy enough durable goods, autos, radios, and other big-ticket items, and as a consequence, sales in automobiles and other manufactured items tailed off. The Federal Reserve Board, enthralled to the Republican pro-business clique, did not curtail bank lending to securities affiliates, as the bank's securities arms were called, until it was too late. Instead, throughout much of the 1920s, the Fed actually expanded the money supply, allowing stock prices to soar in a wild orgy of speculation. At this point in the mythology, Herbert Hoover enters the picture, thoroughly bamboozled by the developments and too uninventive to correct the problems. Lacking the vision of Franklin Roosevelt, Hoover simply allowed things to deteriorate, and he deserved the embarrassment from appellations like Hoovervilles, given to tent cities, and Hoover hankies, given to empty pockets turned inside out. Unwilling to use the power of the federal government to fix the economy, the befuddled Hoover deservedly lost the 1932 election to Franklin Roosevelt, at which point everything improved. Roosevelt's vision and courage through the creation of the New Deal led America out of the Depression. Little of this mythology is true. Consider the notion that the stock market was one gigantic speculative bubble. There is virtually no evidence for that in numerous studies by economic historians. The most any economists come up with is a tiny layer of speculation at the top, one incapable of affecting either stock prices or attitudes toward buying securities. If anything, the market accurately reflected the fantastic growth in American industry. The most rapidly rising stocks in the 1920s had been electric utilities, radios, and autos. Since 1889, industrial use of electricity had zoomed upward by nearly 300%. Little else needs to be said about the impact of autos on America's culture and economy. Certainly, the auto industry was not indicative of speculation. In fact, several elements would have had to be present to make a case for speculation. First, people would have had to invest with little or no information about the securities they were purchasing. This has not been demonstrated. Quite the opposite. Studies have shown that most investors were well informed, especially about foreign bonds that supposedly had dragged down the large banks. As just one example, Charles E. Merrill, the securities genius who perceived that the markets of the future would lie with the vast middle class, constructed his firm's reputation on accurate and honest appraisals of securities. Second, to make the case for speculation, as John Kenneth Galbraith attempted to do, it has been shown that the maldistribution of wealth resulted in most of the tradings being conducted by the wealthy. Yet analyses of bond issues of the day showed that a broad cross-section of Americans snapped up the latest bonds, with the most prominent occupations of the purchasers being schoolteachers, cabbies, and maids. But even the notion that the stock market crash caused the depression itself is egregiously wrong. Although the market may have temporarily reflected a downturn in the economy, the depression was a confluence of several dramatic shocks, especially the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which were made worse by foolish Federal Reserve Board policies and then rapidly accelerated into the abyss by government attempts to solve the problems. We begin to correct the host of thoroughly confused writings about the nation's worst economic episode with an accurate appraisal of the 1920s. Timeline. 1920, Warren Harding elected president. 1922, Washington Conference. 1923, Harding dies in office. Calvin Coolidge assumes presidency. 1923-24, upheaval in Germany, near collapse of Weimar Republic. 1924, Coolidge re-elected. 1926, Locarno Pact. 1928, Kellogg-Briand Treaty, Herbert Hoover elected president. 1929, stock market crash. 1930, Smoot-Hawley Tariff passes Congress, Reconstruction Finance Corporation started. 1930-32, bank collapse, money supply contracts by one-third. 1932, Franklin Roosevelt elected presidency. Return to normalcy. Anyone looking at the American economy from 1919 to 1921 might have been completely misled about the future. The end of World War I brought the return of millions of soldiers and sailors to farms and factories in the United States and Europe, and the destruction wreaked by several years of combat had disrupted normal economic activities, fattened the U.S. government, and glutted the job markets. Farmers were especially devastated, with farm prices plummeting after the European farmers, who had been holding rifles instead of hoes just months earlier, abruptly returned to the land. In the United States, the weakening of the agricultural sector, although not in itself debilitating, had severe but largely hidden repercussions. After 1921, however, the nation made a sharp U-turn. First came a new administration when Warren G. Harding defeated Woodrow Wilson's hand-picked successor, James M. Cox. Cox, a Dayton, Ohio newspaper publisher and governor of Ohio, saw economic activity in a static, bureaucratic way. In his view, the high national debt needed for the war had to be paid off by high taxes. He could not have been more wrong. Andrew Mellon, Harding's Secretary of the Treasury, commissioned a study of why the wealthier classes had paid less and less in taxes as the government raised the tax rate on them repeatedly. He found that high tax rates actually drove money underground. The rich tended to invest abroad rather than build new factories and mills in the United States and then suffer from the 73% tax on any income from those investments. At any rate, Cox's misfortune to be with the incumbent party during a recession was not aided in any way by his view that a correction required more of the same. Wilson's League of Nations had proven equally unpopular, and the infirm president could not campaign for his would-be successor. Oddly enough, Warren Harding, 1865 to 1923, the winner of the 1920 election, would die before the ailing Wilson, whose series of strokes had left him little more than a figurehead during his final months in office. Wilson hung on until 1924. Harding had defeated Cox by the largest plurality up to that time in history, 16.1 million to 9.1 million. The Electoral College vote was 404 to 127. The election was also notable for the showing of socialist Eugene V. Debs, who, while in jail, had still polled almost 1 million votes, as he had in 1912. Debs had run for office from the Hoosegow, while Senator Harding essentially campaigned from his home in Marion, Ohio. A self-made man, Harding, like Cox, created a successful newspaper, the Marion Star. After his nomination by the Republicans, Harding copied Harrison, campaigning from his Marion front porch and greeting the more than 600,000 people who had made the pilgrimage. He invited many reporters to join him in a chew of tobacco or a shot of whiskey. When Harding finally hit the campaign trail, he told a Boston crowd that America needed not nostrums, but normalcy, thus coining the phrase that became his unintended theme. His association with Madison Avenue marketing whiz Albert Lasker led him to introduce state-of-the-art advertising. Without a doubt, Harding's most astute appointment was Andrew Mellon at Treasury. Mellon, whose Pittsburgh family had generated a fortune from oil and banking, understood business better than any Treasury secretary since Hamilton. After his study of falling tax revenues revealed that the amount of money gleaned from the upper classes had declined with each new rate increase, Mellon concluded that lowering the rates on everyone, especially the wealthiest classes, would actually result in their paying more taxes. From 1921 to 1926, Congress reduced rates from 73% on the top income earners and 4% on the lowest taxpayers to 25% and 1.5% respectively, then down even further in 1929. Unexpectedly to everyone except Mellon, the tax take from the wealthy almost tripled, but the poorer classes saw their share of taxes fall substantially. The nation as a whole benefited as the national debt fell by one-third, from $24 billion to $18 billion in 5 years. Mellon's tax policies set the stage for the most amazing growth yet seen in America's already impressive economy. Had Harding appointed a dozen Mellons, he would have been remembered as a great president. But he did not, of course, and many of his appointees were of less than stellar character. A scandal for every occasion. Self-discipline and trustworthiness proved to be lacking in Harry Doherty, the Attorney General, Charles Forbes of the Veterans Bureau, and Albert Fall, the Interior Secretary, all of whom either directly or indirectly fleeced the government. Forbes resigned after a scandal in which he sold U.S. veterans' hospital supplies to his friends. Fall resigned after the infamous Teapot Dome scandal, during which he granted favorable leases for government oil fields in Elk Hills, California, and Teapot Dome, Wyoming, in return for kickbacks totaling $400,000. Teapot Dome would join Credit Mobilier among the worst scandals in American history. It had its origins in a fight over the environment between developmentalists and conservationists. Had the conservationist wing of the Republican Party not become aware of the leases which it opposed and thus made a public issue of them, it is unlikely that the newspapers would have picked up on the issue or that the public would have exhibited such outrage. It would not be the last time that environmental issues would color the political debate over economic development. Any one of the three scandals alone might not have damaged Harding. Taken together, however, the impact tainted his entire administration. Worse, swirling amid those scandals were the suicides of Charles Kramer, the counsel for the Veterans Bureau, and Jess Smith, an associate of Daughtry's. An odor of corruption started to cling to Harding, who, Grant-like, had a knack for appointing crooks and bunglers. Harding commented after the unwelcome publicity that followed one suicide, "I can take care of my enemies, all right, but my damned friends, they're the ones who keep me walking the floor nights." In 1923, before any image restoration could occur, Harding died of a heart attack. His successor, Calvin Coolidge, although eminently capable, had altogether the wrong personality for using the public relations machinery of the White House to rebuild his predecessor's image. On the other hand, as historian Robert Maddox concludes, Silent Cal was in fact the only public figure to come away from the mess with his reputation enhanced. As part of the 20s myth, Coolidge has been ridiculed as lazy, with one text even claiming that he spent only about 4 hours daily on his executive duties, and another offering without qualification that Coolidge hardly worked at all. He napped in the mornings before lunch, dozed a bit after eating, and then he lay down for a few minutes prior to dinner. Yet his work habits reflected the view of government's role in American life, and he also refused to play the public relations game that most politicians practiced. Coolidge had a remarkable ability to refrain from small talk. Known as Silent Cal, Coolidge was once the subject of a bet by two dinner guests. One woman bet another she could get Coolidge to say 3 words in succession. After several unsuccessful tries, she explained the bet to Coolidge, who said, "You lose." Coolidge may not have been a friend of the elites, and he probably was not the quotable, boisterous type the public had become accustomed to with Roosevelt, but he was thoroughly American. Literally born on the 4th of July in 1872, Coolidge grew up on a Vermont farm. A red-headed youngster prone to allergies, Coolidge experienced a constant loneliness that stemmed first from punishments at the hands of his grandmother, then later in 1890 from the death of his sister Abby from appendicitis. These and other events contributed to Coolidge's famous shyness and standoffish nature. Young Coolidge moved off the farm, studied law, and advanced up the ranks in the Massachusetts Republican Party. He became governor of Massachusetts, where he demonstrated his approach to limited government. Explaining that public institutions could never take the place of the private sector and hard work, Coolidge saw self-government as meaning self-support. As Harding's vice president, Coolidge avoided the scandals that had enveloped other members of the administration and remained clean. Appropriately enough, he was asleep at his father's farmhouse the night that a postal messenger arrived with the telegram informing Coolidge that Harding had died and he needed to take the oath of office immediately. The Coolidge home did not have a telephone, but it did have a notary public, Calvin's father, to administer the oath of office by kerosene lamp. Silent Cal pulled off a silent coup within the GOP itself, effectively overthrowing the old guard in that party that had stood with Harding. In his astonishingly brief inaugural address, Coolidge warned Americans not to expect to build up the weak by pulling down the strong, and not to be in a hurry to legislate. When a business or union endangered the public, however, Coolidge acted with decisiveness and skill. During the 1919 Boston police strike, the then-Governor Coolidge had given the strikers enough rope to hang themselves when public opinion ultimately turned against them. At that point, he summoned the National Guard, stating that there was no right to strike against the public safety at any time. That perspective remained with President Coolidge, and it sent a message to business and consumers that he would protect private property from government confiscation. Government expenditures plummeted under the Republicans, falling almost to 1916 levels. Harding had sold off the railroads and shipping taken over by the government during the war and had privatized as much as possible. Overall outlays remained low under both Harding and Coolidge, though they soared under Herbert Hoover. And even after defense expenditures were factored in, real per capita federal expenditures dropped from $170 per year in 1920 to a low of $70 in 1924, and remained well below $100 until 1930, when they reached $101. Coolidge's reluctance to involve the government in labor disputes combined with general prosperity to drive down union membership. Unemployment reached the unheard-of low mark of less than 2% under Coolidge, and workers overall had little to complain about. The AFL's membership dropped by 4 million during the decade, and overall union membership shrank slightly faster. Union leaders shook their heads and complained that affluence and luxury produced by the economy had made unions seem irrelevant. But business had contributed to the weakening of unions as well through a strategy called welfare capitalism, preemptively providing employees with a wide range of benefits without pressure from unions. Government refused to support strikers, and when the railway brotherhoods rejected the Railway Labor Board's 12% reduction in wages for shopmen, the subsequent labor stoppage was met with an injunction from Attorney General Harry Doherty. Government's shifting attitude toward workers, which had been increasingly favorable prior to the 1920s, reflected the difficulty of having Washington involved at all in such matters as setting private sector wages. Many such episodes of the government's refusing to act clearly illustrated the central belief during the Harding-Coolidge years that the government should butt out. The Supreme Court largely agreed, ruling on a number of issues related to government interference, whether to impose taxes on undesirable products, those manufactured by children, Bailey versus Drexel Furniture Company, 1922, or to require that companies pay minimum wages, Adkins versus Children's Hospital, 1923. In so doing, the court reflected the culture of the day, in which children often assumed adult roles in their early teens, and although adolescents were victimized in some instances, the workplace often remained the only path to upward mobility for those who lacked the opportunity to attend college. In addition, the refusal to allow government to set minimum wages for women, far from aiming at depriving women of better-paying jobs, was designed to strengthen the role of the husbands who were primary breadwinners in families. An economic and cultural Goliath. Harding's scandals and untimely death did nothing to impede the steadily expanding economy. Both Harding and Coolidge proved to be good friends to business, if only because they moved the federal government out of the way of economic growth. The main fact was this: unleashed and with government playing only a small role in people's everyday affairs, American entrepreneurs produced the most vibrant 8-year burst of manufacturing and innovation in the nation's history. It was a period that easily compared with any other 8-year period at any time anywhere, including during the Industrial Revolution. American businesses did more than simply turn out more goods, as is implied by critics of the Roaring Twenties. They fostered an environment that enabled the invention of breakthrough devices and products that fundamentally changed the structure of society, perhaps more than the Industrial Revolution itself. Consider the automobile. Prior to the widespread availability of cars, made possible in large part by Henry Ford's moving assembly line and his keen understanding that what people needed was an affordable automobile, people either walked, took trains, or sailed on ships and riverboats. Auto registration rose from just over 9 million in 1921 to 23 million by 1929, whereas automobile production soared 225% during the decade. Ford, of course, had already seen demand for his own product peak prior to the war, when the price of a Ford Model T stood at $345, allowing Ford to sell 734,000 units. Ford's company already was being eclipsed by a new giant, General Motors, GM, a merger of Chevrolet, Oldsmobile, Buick, Cadillac, Fisher Body, Delco, and other firms. Between 1918 and 1920, William Durant, GM's founder, created a company that could satisfy all tastes, whereas the Ford's Model T, you could have any color you wanted as long as it was black. Durant, however, was unable to manage the monster he had created, yielding control to Alfred P. Sloan, Jr., who led GM's surge past Ford during the decade. Whether a Ford or a Chevrolet, however, it was irrelevant which auto Americans drove. What was important was that they were driving more than ever before, generating an unprecedented demand for a wide variety of related materials: metal, lumber, steel, cotton, leather, paint, rubber, glass, and, of course, gasoline. Production of a vast legion of auxiliary items sparked expansion in those businesses as well as in all the firms needed to supply them. Cement plants, housing construction, gasoline, and spare parts firms grew at a dramatic rate. Moreover, the demand for autos led to a related clamoring on the part of drivers that cities and states build roads. State highway road construction soared tenfold between 1918 and 1930. As politicians moved to meet the public need for roads, often through bond financing, states and municipalities often turned to Wall Street, either to supply the capital directly or to place the bond issues. In ways less visible, though, the auto also encouraged opportunity and occupational freedom never before seen in American history. People were no longer tied to inner-city jobs or to sharecropper farms. Instead, they had hope that good jobs awaited just down the road, or in California, which itself became a success story during the decade. Another new technology, the radio, had also leaped onto the scene. The Radio Corporation of America, RCA, had been formed in 1919 to take over the assets of the American Marconi Company. The new radio medium utilized broadcasting, in which the transmitter sent signals out over the airwaves for whoever wanted to pick them up, as opposed to the two-way wireless communication associated with a walkie-talkie. RCA expected that it could make money by providing the broadcasting free and selling the radio sets. In 1920, Westinghouse, one of the RCA partners, applied for the first radio station license in Pittsburgh, and in October, the first World Series broadcast was heard. On November 2nd of that year, some 500 listeners tuned in to coverage of Harding's presidential victory. By 1922, more than 200 stations were operating, and radio soon began to feature paid advertisements for products, giving birth to the modern practice of sponsor payment for programming on public airwaves. Perhaps it was no coincidence that the best-known baseball player of all time, and perhaps the most dominant athlete in any sport at any time in American history, George Herman Babe Ruth, 1895 to 1948, captured America's imagination just as radio could broadcast his exploits, among which was setting the record in 1927 of 60 home runs in a single season. A larger-than-life figure, Ruth not only led all of baseball in both home runs and strikeouts, but according to most contemporary newspaper accounts, he also surpassed any other player in his ability to party all night, carouse, smoke cigars, and then play a doubleheader. Motion pictures, another new technology, competed with radio as a main source of public entertainment. Movies originated with Thomas Edison in the late 1880s, and in 1903, The Great Train Robbery became the first movie with a recognizable plot. Over a decade later, D.W. Griffith produced The Birth of a Nation about the Civil War, arguably creating the first true modern-era motion picture. But the greatest motion picture director of all, Cecil B. DeMille, captured the grand sweep of the 1920s with his epics The Ten Commandments, 1923, and King of Kings, 1927. Warner Brothers, however, provided the decade's key breakthrough when Al Jolson appeared in the first film with a soundtrack, The Jazz Singer, 1927. Previously, movies had relied on written text to move the plot along, although posher theaters featured live organists or even orchestras playing along with the screen action. Jolson's breakthrough opened the floodgates for the talkies, instantly ending the careers of many silent film artists who looked appealing but sounded bad and demanding more overall of the actor's craft. With the industry producing up to 500 movies a year, in a short time, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, Rudolph Valentino, Charlie Chaplin, and Clara Bow would epitomize the lavish lifestyles and celebrity culture that later was synonymous with Hollywood. Next to The Jazz Singer, though, was the other revolutionary motion picture of the decade, this one starring a mouse. Walter Elias Walt Disney, an illustrator and animator, had dreamed of producing a full-length motion picture cartoon. He took a giant step toward fulfilling that dream with Steamboat Willie in 1928, which introduced the world to a whistling Mickey Mouse. Motion pictures and radios were joined by another new consumer item, the telephone. In 1920, for every 1,000 city dwellers, there were 61 telephones. By 1928, the number had risen to 92 per 1,000. Wets versus dries. As the idealism of prohibition faded and the reality of crime associated with bootlegging set in, the effort to ban alcohol began to unravel. One reason was that enforcement mechanisms were pitifully weak. The government had hired only 1,500 agents to support local police, compared to the 1,000 gunmen in Al Capone's employ, added to the dozens of other gangs of comparable size. Gunplay and violence, as law enforcement agents tried to shut down bootlegging operations, led to countless deaths. Inter-gang warfare killed hundreds in Chicago alone between 1920 and 1927. By some estimates, the number of bootleggers and illegal saloons went up after Prohibition. Washington, D.C. and Boston both saw the stratospheric increase in the number of liquor joints. Kansas, the origin of the dry movement, did not have a town where alcohol could not be obtained, at least according to an expert witness before the House Judiciary Committee. The leadership of the early prohibition movement included many famous women, such as Carrie Nation, who were concerned with protecting the nuclear family from the assault by liquor and prostitution. She was wrong in her assessment of the problem. Far from protecting women by improving the character of men, Prohibition perversely led women down to the saloon. Cocktails especially were in vogue among these liberated women who, like their reformer sisters, came from the ranks of the well-to-do. Liquor spread through organized crime into the hands or bellies of the lower classes only gradually in the 1920s, eventually entering into the political arena with the presidential campaign of Al Smith. By that time, much of the support for Prohibition had disappeared because several factors had coalesced to destroy the dry coalition. First, the dries lost some of their flexible and dynamic leaders, who in turn were replaced with more dogmatic and less imaginative types. Second, dry politicians, who were already in power, bore much of the blame for the economic fallout associated with the market crash in 1929. Third, public tastes had shifted, literally in some cases, to accommodate the new freedom of the age represented by the automobile and the radio. Restricting individual choices about anything did not fit well with those new icons. Finally, states chafed under federal laws. Above all, the liquor industry pumped massive resources into the repeal campaign, obtaining a monopoly on press coverage by providing reporters with reliable and constant information. By the late 1920s and early 1930s, it was unusual to find a story about prohibition in small local papers that did not have its origin with the anti-prohibition forces. Not to be discounted either was the fact that the intelligentsia turned against prohibition. Neo-Freudians, the rage in psychology circles, scorned the reformers, in sharp contrast to the pre-World War I sympathy they'd enjoyed in intellectual circles. Psychologists now saw progressive reformers as sexually repressed meddlers. All of these factors led toward the inexorable repeal of prohibition with the 21st Amendment in 1933. Still, for history written since the 1960s, where an open society was deemed the highest good and any restrictions on personal freedom were viewed as inherently autocratic, prohibition left a more mixed legacy than is commonly portrayed. In the first place, it was not designed to stop private individuals from drinking, but only to eliminate the source of, as the reformers saw it, evil and misery, the saloon. Moreover, historians have displayed a nearly irresistible urge to saddle white rural Protestants with prohibition, despite its female upper to upper middle class urban origins. A concurrent lack of attention was given to the measurable results of prohibition. The U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, for example, prepared a report called Alcohol and Health in 1971, which showed that per capita consumption of alcoholic beverages fell by at least 40% in 1920, marking a permanent reduction in drinking. Economist Clark Warburton's 1932 study analyzed a wide array of data, all of which were refined further by other economists in 1948. The conclusion of these studies was that alcohol consumption declined by 30 to 50%, or roughly what the 1971 HEW report had claimed. Other benefits of prohibition are mixed. Arrests for public drunkenness fell, leading to lower public expenses for dealing with drunks. The rates of alcoholic psychoses fell, and medical problems related to drinking in almost every category plummeted so much that medical journals scarcely mentioned it as a public health problem. What about the crime wave associated with prohibition? Norman Clark points out, "There is no reason to suppose that the speakeasy, in any quantifiable way, replaced the saloon. In fact, most Americans outside the larger cities never knew a bootlegger, never saw a speakeasy, and would not have known where to look for one." Federal expenditures for law enforcement rose at an annual rate of 17.5% during the Prohibition years, with liquor-related enforcement costs exceeding budgets and revenues from licenses every year. Defenders of prohibition argued that crime was growing anyway, and that gambling, not liquor, remained organized crime's major money source. Prohibition may have accelerated the rise of the gangsters, but it did not cause the rise of organized crime. Prohibition therefore provided ammunition for both sides of the public health debate in subsequent generations. Thus, it usually came down to issues about personal rights. Critics pointed to its later failures, supporters to its early successes. Above all, however, prohibition was a progressive movement in which some people claiming superior morality sought to control the lives of others for the public good. Perhaps the most long-lasting effect of prohibition was how this inoculated alcohol from the large-scale future public action that afflicted tobacco and had begun to be directed at everyday food products, which in sheer numbers affected the health of people far less than did drinking. Bulls and bulls. Prohibition's social sideshow had little effect on the continued technological advances of the 20s and their spillover effect on the stock market and the American economy. Improved productivity in the brokerage and investment firms expanded their ability to provide capital for the growing number of auto factories, glassworks, cement plants, tire manufacturers, and dozens of other complementary enterprises. Moreover, both traditional manufacturing and the new industries of radio, movies, finance, and telephones all required electricity. With electric power applied as never before, the utilities industries also witnessed a boom. In 1899, for example, electrical motors accounted for only 5% of all the installed horsepower in the United States. But 30 years later, electrical power accounted for 80% of the installed horsepower. One estimate found that electricity could increase productivity on a given task by two-thirds. Productivity per factory man-hour rose by an astonishing 75% from 1922 to 1928. That automobile-electrical nexus probably would have sustained the great bull market by itself, but added to it were several other unrelated industries, including radio broadcasters, who reached 7.5 million sets by 1928. Radio broadcasting stood uniquely among all industries in that it depended entirely on advertising for its sustenance. Advertising revenues on radio had accounted for $350 million by the middle of the decade, reflecting the growing power of Madison Avenue and professional advertising. For the first time, advertising and professional marketing entered the mainstream of American society, shucking the aura of hucksterism associated with P.T. Barnum. All this growth, energy, and American industrial success alarmed the Europeans. In 1927, at the International Economic Conference in Geneva, which met at the behest of the French, proposals were put forward for an economic league of nations whose long-term goal is the creation of a United States of Europe. This was, according to the chairman, the sole economic formula which can effectively fight against the United States of America. English writer J.B. Priestley complained a few years later that British roads only differ in a few minor details from a few thousand such roads in the United States, where the same toothpastes and soaps and gramophone records are being sold, the very same films are being shown here. Europeans seemed uniformly wary of the rising American economic might, with books such as America Coming of Age, 1927, warning of the rising giant across the Atlantic. We should not discount these reactions because they underscored the fact that the U.S. economy was robust and reinforced evidence that the stock market boom was not an illusion. Rather than a frenzy of speculation, the great bull market reflected the fantastic growth in genuine production, which did not fall. Consequently, stocks did not fall either. Using an index of common stock prices for the year 1900 equaling 100, the index topped 130 in 1922, 140 in 1924, 320 in 1928, and 423 in October 1929. Individual stocks refused to go down. Radio Corporation of America, RCA, never paid a single dividend, yet its stock went from $85 a share to $289 a share in 1928 alone. General Motors' stock that was worth $25,000 in 1921 was valued at $1 million in 1929. Was that all speculation? It is doubtful. GM produced $200 million in profits in 1929 alone. Samuel Insull's massive electric network, which consistently lowered prices for consumers, only seemed to expand. Who did not want electricity? In virtually all cases, radios, cars, electricity, banking, Corporate giants such as Ford and David Sarnoff, Insull and A.P. Giannini democratized products by lowering prices by several orders of magnitude. Almost every walk of life saw some American, many of them recent immigrants, come up with a new product that pushed prices down and convenience up. Leo Baekeland, a Belgian chemist who came to the United States in the late 1800s, worked for Eastman Photography, where he helped develop a revolutionary photography paper, then used the small fortune he got from the sale of that product to create one of the first commercial plastics in America, Bakelite. Instantly, manufacturers substituted plastic, which they could easily mold, for door handles, gear shift knobs, radiator caps, and myriad other parts. And Bakelite, like so many other products, further forced down prices for ordinary Americans. Moreover, new research of patentable assets suggests that the 1920s was a remarkable era for the rise of knowledge capital. Innovation was a significant driver of stock market values, and the crash did not reflect a significant revaluation of knowledge capital relative to physical capital. Certainly, the securities firms gave the market a push whenever possible, mostly through margin sales, in which an individual could put down as little as 10% early in the decade to purchase stock, using the stock itself as collateral for the 90% borrowed from the broker. By mid-decade, most firms had raised their margins to 15%, yet margin buying continued to accelerate, going from $1 billion in 1921 to $8 billion in 1929. But it wasn't only the rich investing in the market. In 1900, 15% of American families owned stock. By 1929, 28% of American families held stock. One analysis of those buying at least 50 shares of stock in one large utility issue showed that the most numerous purchasers, in order, were housekeepers, clerks, factory workers, merchants, chauffeurs and drivers, electricians, mechanics, and foremen. In other words, hardly the wealthy speculators that critics of the 20s would suggest. The fact that many Americans were better off than they had ever been before deeply disturbed some, partly because the middle class was rapidly closing in on the moneyed elites. Writers like F. Scott Fitzgerald sneered that Americans had engaged in the greatest, gaudiest spree in history. Others, employing religious models, viewed the prosperity of the 1920s as a materialist binge that required a disciplinary correction. But the facts of the consumer durables revolution reflected both the width and depth of the wealth explosion. By 1928, American homes had 15 million irons, 6.8 million vacuum cleaners, 5 million washers, 4.5 million toasters, and 750,000 electric refrigerators. Housing construction reached record levels beginning in 1920, when the United States embarked on the longest building boom in history. By the middle of the decade, more than 11 million families had acquired homes, three-fourths of which had electrical power by 1930. During the 1920s, total electrical product sales had increased to $2.4 billion. Per capita income had increased from $522 to $716 between 1921 and 1929 in real terms, and such a rising tide of affluence allowed people to save and invest as never before, acquiring such instruments of savings as life insurance policies. Indeed, the notion, first offered by John Maynard Keynes in his General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, 1936, and later championed by John Kenneth Galbraith in The Great Crash, 1955, that consumer purchasing fell behind the productivity increases, causing a glut of goods late in the decade, doesn't wash. In 1921, the consumer share of GNP was $54 billion, and it quickly rose to $73 billion, adding 5% at a time when consumer prices were falling. It gave consumers the available cash to own not only stocks and bonds, but also to control 5/6 of the world's production of autos, one car for every 5 people in America, and allowed a growing number of people to engage in travel by air. In 1920, there were only 40,000 air passengers, but by 1930, the number had leaped to 417,000, and it shot up again to 3.1 million by 1940. It is essential to understand the intellectual stake the modern left has in debunking the real growth of the 1920s to set the stage for its speculation theories. Only if the phenomenal growth and wealth of the 1920s can be explained away in terms of a greedy mania can the unprecedented intervention of government in the 1930s be even partially justified. But such was not the case, although the soaring level of investment in securities and the business boom fostered the legend that both Harding and Coolidge were rabid pro-business types. Attackers have especially and selectively repeated Coolidge's comment that the business of America is business, and his suggestion that the man who builds a factory builds a temple. What did Coolidge really say about business? We live in an age of abounding accumulation of material things. These did not create our declaration. Our declaration created them. The things of spirit come first. Criticized by historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who served as the court historian for Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy, as wanting a business government, Coolidge, in fact, said that America needed a government that will understand business. I mean, a government able to establish the best possible relations between the people in their business capacity and the people in their social capacity. Silent Cal had a few weaknesses, including his intolerance for the insubordinate, but ultimately accurate predictions of Colonel Billy Mitchell and his support of tariffs. Overall, though, it was Coolidge's moral compass and self-control over executive power that allowed the bulls to dominate Wall Street. Contributing to the great bull market, however, were successful foreign policies that also helped usher in a decade of peace that contributed to the prosperity. A tornado of cheering. Following the Great War, the worst war in human history up to that point, few nations had the resources or the desire to fan even the smallest embers of conflict. The Republican administrations sought to go even further, however, by ensuring peace through active negotiations to limit weapons, encouraging discussions among the former enemies, and assisting the German Weimar Republic when it experienced rampant inflation in the mid-1920s. These were not isolationist positions in the least, nor did they characterize small government views associated with the Republicans, especially when it came to the German question. Germany, saddled with tremendous and in many ways unreasonable war reparation debts from World War I, had been consigned to a form of national servitude to Britain and France after the conflict. Among other penalties, Germany had to provide France with thousands of locomotives and railroad cars free, and give to Britain hundreds of thousands of tons of shipping, again at no cost. Because the Treaty of Versailles demanded that Germany pay billions of marks to France, Germany simply devalued the mark and printed currency in geometric increments, handing the French, in essence, worthless money. When the French converted the marks into francs and then shipped the converted marks back home to Germany, hyperinflation ensued. In a matter of months, German currency plummeted to such lows in value that people burned money in fireplaces and stoves because it was cheaper than using the money to buy wood. France moved in to take over German industries in the Ruhr Valley, and tensions escalated. Fearing another war, the United States devised a 1924 plan implemented by Charles G. Dawes. A banker who had coordinated procurement in Europe during the war, Dawes had become a household name following his kinetic post-war testimony before Congress. Grilled about paying top dollar for supplies, Dawes leaped from a witness chair shouting, "Helen Maria, I would have paid horse prices for sheep if sheep could have pulled artillery to the front." When the wire services carried the line, they garbled the "Helen Maria" phrase, a Nebraska farm saying, so it read, "Hell and Maria." Dawes quickly became an icon in American pop culture. Such a man was perfect to head the committee to untangle the reparations mess. Coolidge, admonishing the members before they left, said, "Just remember that you are Americans." By April 1924, the Dawes Committee had completed its work. It proposed that German reparations be lowered, that the Deutschmark be pegged to the gold-based American dollar, that half of future reparations come from taxes, and that the United States lend Germany some of the money to get back on its feet. Dawes thus diffused the situation, sharing the Nobel Peace Prize the following year with Sir Josiah Stamp, another member of the delegation who had done the number crunching. The Dawes plan perhaps staved off war, and certainly the loans returned to American business to purchase U.S. products. Concerns over naval power also dominated post-war policy. After the war, Congress had refused to continue to appropriate money for the Naval Act, which would have created the largest fleet in the world. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes rightly saw naval affairs as the most critical elements of America's near-term security. No nation in the world could have launched air attacks on the United States in the 1920s, and landing any ground troops would have required an armada as yet unseen in human history. Increasingly, however, America depended on trade, and any threat to U.S. trade routes concerned Washington. Delegates from the major naval powers of the world were invited to a conference in Washington in 1921. Hughes directed the tenor and direction of the meeting toward arms limitations, especially on what some had called the ultimate weapon, the battleship. Like many arms control agreements that followed, the Five Power Pact that emerged from the Washington Conference relied on maintaining rough equality of weapons among the participants, enforcing a sort of balance of terror. Signatories agreed to limits on the tonnage, that is, tons of water displaced as an indicator of the size and often type of ship, each nation would build. For every 525,000 tons of capital ships the United States built, England could build the same amount. Japan could build 315,000 tons, and France and Italy 175,000 tons each. Over time, the agreement came to be referred to by a sort of shorthand reference to the tonnage limitations, namely the 5-5-3 ratio. Moreover, Hughes urged the delegates to cancel production entirely on all those battleships currently under construction. Met with a tornado of cheering as delegates whooped and embraced, the agreement was a typically utopian and wrong-headed approach to maintaining peace. Nations indeed limited the tonnage of ships, but instantly cheated by changing both the character and lethality of such vessels. On the one hand, they shifted production to a newer ship type that would soon prove far more potent, the aircraft carrier, which had not been covered in the agreement. And on the other, they simply installed more and bigger guns on existing platforms. Indeed, many of the Japanese carriers that struck Pearl Harbor were battleship hulls converted in the wake of the Washington agreements and retrofitted with carrier decks. And it was no accident that the size of long-range guns mounted on existing battleships and cruisers increased, from 12 to 14 inches aboard the USS Arizona, sunk at Pearl Harbor, to the 16-inch guns of the USS Missouri and the 18-inch guns of the German super-battleships Bismarck and Tirpitz. Japan topped everyone with its massive battleships Yamato and Musashi, each featuring 9 18-inch guns. All nations reinvigorated their submarine programs as well. Thus, the Washington Conference had the ironic effect of encouraging the development of two new weapons, the carrier and the submarine, that would prove far more effective than the increasingly obsolete battleships the treaties sought to control. Few paid any attention to such realities. The euphoria of arms control reached its absurd conclusion in 1928 with the Kellogg-Briand Pact, named for Frank Kellogg, U.S. Secretary of State, and Aristide Briand, French Foreign Minister, which outlawed war. War was now illegal. One wonders if the delegates had considered repealing the law of gravity while they were at it. The ink on this incredible document, signed with a foot-long pen of gold, remained dry for scarcely a decade before Adolf Hitler plunged the world into the most catastrophic war in human history. Coolidge refused to be sucked into the orbit of the outlawists. He did not oppose arms limitations on general grounds, but rather doubted that the European powers would limit their own numbers of ships in any significant way. He had the luxury of knowing that, in a practical sense, the only way the United States was vulnerable to a direct attack was by sea, and therefore American security could be achieved by reducing the ability of others to build capital ships. Coolidge also saw the potential for arms reductions to further limit the size of government expenditures, and thus the size of government, something he always considered worthwhile. Significantly, after a brief foray into an international arms reduction agreement in 1926-27, Coolidge realized that foreign powers were not about to sacrifice any advantages they held. In 1927, he therefore recommended a 9-year naval development program, and although he never completely surrendered hope that the powers could restrict their sea strength, he could take no chances with his country's defenses. It was vintage Coolidge: reduce government, promote peace, but protect yourself and stand firm when necessary. The New Deal writ small. Coolidge could have stood for re-election, but he chose not to. In his autobiography, he pointed to the fact that presidents who served 8 years were not effective in the latter parts of their term. Some suspect Coolidge sensed that an economic downturn lay ahead. Still others point to odd statements by Coolidge, whose son died in 1924 of an infected blister on his foot, suggesting the president believed his death was some sort of spiritual price exacted for occupying the White House. Whatever the reason, with typical Coolidge brusqueness during a press conference, the president quietly marched down a line of newsmen, handing them each a little strip of paper with the words, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928. His successor, Herbert Clark Hoover, 1874 to 1964, could not have been more different from Silent Cal. The Secretary of Commerce, who had headed the Food Administration during the First World War, Hoover represented the latest in a long line of Republican progressives whom Coolidge despised. Hoover thus inherited the Teddy Roosevelt, William Howard Taft wing of the Republican Party. In some ways, this progressivism, especially as exhibited by Hoover, was a type of devout religiosity, with an emphasis on perfection of this world as opposed to the traditional Christianity practiced by Coolidge with its presumption of man's sinful nature. Certainly Hoover was religious. He was born of Iowa Quaker stock, and his church training stayed with him to the point where he refused to play in Harding's White House poker games. Far from being conservative in the 19th century sense of the word, Hoover's views entitled him to be described by one biographer as a forgotten progressive. He displayed his forward-looking views across a wide spectrum of policies, telling his confidants that he wanted very much to appoint a woman to a distinguished position only a decade after women had received the franchise, adding, "If I could find a distinguished woman to appoint." His policies anticipated most aspects of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal depression remedies. Of course, many of the comments hailing Hoover as a progressive come from a liberal historical school that endorsed the expansion of government, and by any yardstick, Hoover was a big government type. The Department of Commerce increased its bureaucracy under Hoover, growing by more than 2,000 employees and $13 million at a time when every other department in government was shrinking. He was the quintessential manager in both the best and worst senses of the word, coining new phrases and generating streams of new reports. It should not be a surprise that, before running against him in an election, Franklin D. Roosevelt called him a wonder and added, "I wish we could make him president. There couldn't be a better one." Those same traits, his obsession with paperwork and bureaucratic forms, caused Coolidge to hold him in contempt, calling him Wonder Boy, and noting that Hoover had given him unsolicited advice for 6 years, all of it bad. Hoover was too entrenched to kick out, but Silent Cal had scarcely said a good word about him, even during the campaign. Hoover's work with the bureaucracy took his natural affinity for capitalism and seasoned it with a dose of corporatism, the notion that large-scale planned organizations could direct outcomes better than a laissez-faire method. But perhaps a better word for describing Hoover's approach to government than corporatism, which often suggested a form of Benito Mussolini's fascism, was activism, or even a revival of the old mercantilist view of the world. As Commerce Secretary, he sought to rationalize the coal industry, an approach that would have horrified Lincoln or Jefferson. He concocted a scheme reminiscent of Albert Gallatin's Inland Waterway Plan, proposing a comprehensive system of inland waterways that would aid the farmer. These private, public, corporation policies allowed biographers to claim that Hoover's presidency incorporated a philosophy of individualism through the coordination of capital, government, and labor. Despite his willingness to employ the federal government to solve problems, Hoover's name, especially after the Depression, was almost exclusively associated with rugged individualism in a negative sense. As the economic collapse deepened, people assumed he did not care for their plight, despite the fact that he had pushed federal involvement in the private sector to unprecedented peacetime levels. It did not help that he had written a book called American Individualism in 1922. Unlike Coolidge, who had no compunction about allowing a recession to lower wages, Hoover saw high wages as critical to maintaining prosperity. In that respect, he displayed the classic Keynesian approach to economics that would soon captivate policymakers in the West. Demand was what counted, not supply. Hoover won in 1928 because of Coolidge's peace and prosperity, always a tough row to hoe for a political opponent. The opponent, Democratic candidate Alfred E. Smith, governor of New York, represented the growing anti-prohibition movement. Smith, a Catholic, suffered from anti-Catholic prejudices and the American distrust of New York urbanites, which helped Hoover, as did his Quaker moralism and his seeming concern for common Americans. "A chicken for every pot and a car for every garage," he intoned, and the press that he had carefully cultivated carried his proclamations with enthusiasm. Major newspapers endorsed him wholeheartedly. Some of their commentary seemed absurd, given the scorn the nation heaped on him just 4 years later. He was called the most useful American citizen now alive, a new force in economic and social life, associated with unfailing integrity and even a genius. In some ways, Smith held positions more conservative and more in line with Harding and Coolidge than did Hoover. He opposed government interference with business and the rising expenditures of federal agencies, and he favored restraining or cutting back the Washington bureaucracy. More Americans voted in the presidential election of 1928 than ever before, 67.5% of those eligible, and Hoover won in a landslide, 444 electoral votes to Smith's 87, racking up more than 21.3 million popular votes in the process. Yet Smith virtually swept the big cities, St. Louis, Cleveland, San Francisco, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, and so on, laying the groundwork for the Roosevelt coalition 4 years later. It marked the first time in the 20th century that the big urban areas went overwhelmingly Democratic, and they have remained so to the present day. From the hindsight of nearly 70 years, it would appear that when Hoover was inaugurated in 1929, he had jumped behind the wheel of a flaming gasoline truck with no brakes headed over a cliff. But only in hindsight. Hoover's perspective was that he had the opportunity to end the business cycle once and for all, to use the tools of government to manage minor drips and hiccups. Given the emphasis on planning, could not any obstacle be overcome? With enough information, could not even the economy be controlled? Crash and Depression. On October 29, 1929, the economy just dropped off the table. Or so the story goes. In fact, several sectors of the economy had experienced slow growth or even stagnation in the 1920s. Then there was the Federal Reserve, which failed to expand the money supply at a pace that would support the growth over the long haul. The slow drain caused by the weakened agricultural sector had started to afflict the financial structure. Manufacturing indices started a natural slowdown by mid-1928. These rather hidden factors were greatly exacerbated by the Smoot-Hawley tariff. Then, once the crash occurred, the government made almost every poor policy decision possible. Farming had never recovered from the end of World War I. By 1927, farm bankruptcies stood at about 1.8 per 100, a rate lower than all American businesses. And farm income averaged $7 billion from 1923 to